welcome back to another episode of Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi. This week's episode is entitled Multiverse New York. Get out of the multiverse right now. It is everywhere. It's in the Marvel movies. It's in at the Oscars with Everything Everywhere All at Once. And now it's in the Spideyverse. So we've got to tackle it this week. But we're not just going to stick to comic book movies and 20th century action flicks. We're going to talk about how it's kind of been explored in a lot of films throughout the years. And all of those films are going to be set in New York, which I think makes a lot of sense when you think about the fact that it kind of attracts these kinds of discussions around being overwhelmed with infinite stories from all different backgrounds. And if you think about a film like New York, I Love You, where it compiles a bunch of short stories and short films by lots of different directors, or that episode of Master of None, the Aziz Ansari film, it's got that kind of pulp show, it's got that Pulp Fiction kind of vibe where it links one character to another, and there's a great deal of authorial intrusion. These are stories about stories. But winding out of that, there's stories about the people who are telling us these stories, about the directors and the writers who write them and that sort of thing. But look, folks, this is a dense week. There's a lot to cover. These three films are Annie Hall, directed by Woody Allen from 1977. We're then going to talk about Synecdoche, New York, by Charlie Kaufman from 2008. And we're going to finish off with the new Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse film, directed by Joachim Dos Santos, Ken Powers, and Justin K. Thompson, a new release this week. So we really got to get straight into it to cover everything that we want to cover this week. So let's kick it off now with Annie Hall, directed by Woody Allen. And this is probably one you wouldn't think of when we're putting with comic book multiverse movies, but have a think about it in terms of going in between different dimensions, particularly with respect to the artistic realm and reality. And we mentioned before authorial intrusion, trying to break that barrier down between story and storyteller. This really is a go-to film for that sort of thing. So just quickly in terms of plot and themes, the story is about the basic sort of two-dimensional story is about starring Woody Allen and Diane Keaton, an on-again, off-again relationship with Alvy Singer, played by Alan, and the girl Annie Hall, who he sort of laments the fact that he gave her up and lost her, and you know, they went back and forth, will they, won't they, kind of throughout the whole thing. And the whole thing is against this backdrop of an Alan-esque, Freud-fueled existential angst and existential angst and paranoia, which I just, even though it's not super central to what we're saying this week, I think it's relevant in the sense that a lot of the themes we've spoken about in recent episodes, you know, things about the existentialism and the universe expanding and the end of the world and that sort of thing, which we've touched on a lot this year. I think it's very relevant as well to this I know postmodernism and existentialism are separate concepts, but I think they do interweave into one another. You know, one can feel a sense of existential dread in nihilism. If you think about a guy like Nietzsche, and nihilism is very often associated with postmodernism, in that it sort of it kind of disposes of traditional senses of moral roadmaps. And if you think about a guy like Albert Camus, again, not a postmodernist as such, but the idea of, you know, not adhering to a specific sense of how one should live their life, and not adhering necessarily to habitual ideas around how one should live their life and what's right and what's wrong and that sort of thing. But being cynical of right and wrong, good and bad, these are things, you know, Foucault himself was quite influenced by Nietzsche. So that's, I think it's just worth mentioning at the beginning. But why are we talking about it this week specifically? Well, from the first scene, Alan is famously breaks the fourth wall. And obviously, Annie Hall isn't the first film to do this. We talked about Crazy Pete, the Jean-Luc Godard film a couple of weeks ago. They do it in that film, and this was something that was done throughout Godard's career earlier than this film. But this one really plays into the idea of breaking the fourth wall throughout, and very deliberately. And also the film is set in New York, and there's a couple of other reasons that we're going to talk about in a second, but that's kind of why it's relevant as well this week, because this idea of breaking the fourth wall, there's an outcome from that, particularly in combination with the idea of existentialism and feeling like not knowing what to do with one's life or knowing what the right thing is to do in any given moment. So in one sense, it's just a basic literary technique or a cinematic technique, I should say, that engages an audience. You know, you're speaking directly to the person watching the film. But more importantly, at least in my view anyway, it breaks down this barrier between the art and the artist. So what we are watching is more than just a two-dimensional story. It's more than just a piece of entertainment that exists in and of itself and for its own sake. In some, and this is probably the crucial statement, it's not just a story that exists in some other dimension, right? I mean, sometimes people say things like they go to the movies to get away from their life, to escape from reality. What this film does by breaking the fourth wall is it sort of says that the art and the artist are connected, which is actually very ironic given that Woody Allen himself is often someone that we like to disconnect from their art because we like the movies but we don't like the guy. But what when we watch a film like this, we're actually dealing with an actual human being, not just telling us about life, but telling us about their life. What we're watching is not just something nice that we can giggle and laugh at. This is something that kind of happened to a person. This is something that happens to us. It's something that happens to people such as this man standing right in front of us. So we kind of need to engage with it as human beings that live in this global community, let's say. And this idea is carried on throughout the film in a lot of other ways as well, not just the breaking of the fourth wall, but that the film itself is undeniably autobiographical. And that's almost to an irritating extent. Orson Welles famously, or infamously, depending on who you like more, talked about how much he hated Woody Allen because he used art as this like means of therapy for himself and like a personal kind of selfish level. And this is going to have a lot of relevance in a second when we talk about the next film that we're going to discuss today. So it's kind of like a means of Allen using, you know, he makes the film to kind of as a means of therapy for himself and the grievances he's experienced in his life. But also on the flip side of that, you know, comparing it to what it otherwise could be, the scenes where Alfie goes to LA and he's very cynical about the TV culture and the network culture over there and how, you know, there's the scene with the switchboard and the adding the audience laughter to the TV show that they're editing, or he's in the studio looking at being edited, talking about, you know, that being so disingenuous, being inauthentic, and that art should really be, the streamline between what you're seeing and you as the viewer should be so much more honest and truthful, and that comes from telling stories that actually happened to you or being inspired by experiences you've actually had. But also very conspicuously, the character Allen plays, Alfie Singer, directs at the very sort of near the end of the film, directs a play in which actors play dressed up versions of him and Annie Hall, which is pretty much the, in a perfect sense, the seed of our next film. But before we jump into that, just a reminder, you are listening to 2XX FM 98.3. I am your host, Jimmy Bernasconi. For the remainder of this half-hour slot, please stay tuned for more quality radio programming and jump onto our website to consider sponsoring or subscribing to the station. Let's move on now to our second film, Synecdoche, New York, directed by Charlie Kaufman. If we're going to talk about jumping in between layers of, you know, where the story starts and where it finishes and where the author is and where they live. And we've got to do a Charlie Kaufman film adaptation, would have also worked very well for this one. But there's so much to get through with this one, so let's do our best to get through it. But on a basic level, if you haven't seen the film, the plot centers on this playwright played by Philip Seymour Hoffman. His name's Caden. And it's really important, I think, when you talk about this film to talk about the beginning of it, the beginning sequence. He's kind of drowning in these countless, very relatable, everyday grievances, but in a kind of surreal sense. It reminded me so much of, I'd actually never seen this film before, and then when I watched it this week, it reminded me a lot of when I saw Beau Is Afraid a couple of weeks ago. There's very clear inspiration there. And he's given this huge grant, and anyway, I just want to emphasize, it's very important, he is dealing with a lot of everyday grievances. He's a tortured soul at the beginning of this film, and is given this huge grant to direct a play, which he does, and basically uses the play, and this is where the film becomes increasingly surreal. He builds essentially a set of his life and then hires actors to play characters or people that he knows in his life, and essentially uses the play to understand his own life and existence. So a second ago we were talking about using art as a means of therapy. That's certainly what's happening literally in this film, and one could say that that's what Kaufman is doing by writing the film about a guy that uses art as a means to learn more about his life and et cetera and et cetera. And there's this sort of endless kind of Russian doll thing going on in this film if you haven't seen it. So that's kind of like the basic plot. But in terms of like a thematic premise, it is very extreme. It's a very complicated film, but in a simplistic sense, what we could say is that it analogizes understanding one's own existence or understanding life in general through the production or through directing a play. And it's through this metaphor that we learn a lot about the experience of life. And it's a very apt metaphor. It's a very, very smart idea. And it obviously lifts up ideas like all the world's a stage. I think that sort of comes to mind a lot when you watch the film. But you'll if you haven't seen the film, you'll see when you watch it how the conveying life or conceiving life as a production on a stage, particularly the idea of, I mean, we're going to get into it more in a second, but it's a very apt metaphor for how we understand the world and performance and what we interpret, that understanding that in the same way that plays are to be interpreted, so too is life. And as an audience member versus a director versus a producer, et cetera, the relationship between the things that we see performed and how we interpret them are very similar in both realms. But let's get into the nitty gritty of it, right? It's at this point, I think, in talking about how let's firstly say that basically as the production goes on, right, Caden is compelled to add more and more characters, more and more scenes, because he's trying to learn more about himself and his life, and so the film becomes somewhat of a psychedelic, surreal downward spiral, right? And it's at this point, I think it's really important that we flesh out this idea of the synecdoche element of the film. So if you're not aware what a synecdoche is, it's a literary term which means like where you have a part or a component being representative of the whole to which it corresponds. So the obvious example that people often use is referring to a car as a set of wheels. So a wheel is just a component of a car, but when you say set of wheels, or set of wheels is just a component of a car, but when you say that, it means the whole car. Or if you say something like Australia has won the cricket, which we did, congratulations, it's not Australia the country, it's the Australian cricket team, which is representative of the whole, but it's not the entire country of Australia winning the cricket. So there's a vice versa element of it too that's important. But if we want to transplant that into the context of people, right? I think this film lifts up this interesting idea of a person is representative of the whole world and vice versa. The whole world is representative, that, you know, that the life of the entire population is kind of representative of the individual. And that might be a bit abstract to begin with, but if we look at how the film deals with it, it makes a lot more sense. So basically, as this guy fleshes out his life more and more, we start to see that the life of any given individual is so expansive and complex that the entire story of life and humanity is pretty much contained within that given individual's life. So we even get a bit of dialogue in the film where Philip Seymour Hoffman talks about how every one of the actors that he's using in this play are the lead in their own respective story. And if you think about anyone you know, like we all experience the full myriad of human emotions, right? Pain, pleasure, love, compassion. And of course, it's to varying extents for different people. No two lives are exactly the same, but a human life, if you had to break it all apart, any human life, you would have millions upon millions of profound stories to tell. It's just a matter of telling them. And this is where the sort of postmodern condition really comes up in this film. But there's a second element that I want to talk about, and the film goes further than that, because it's also an exploration of how we respond to the world, speaking of postmodernism. So the film makes a very profound point about human observation, because the characters in the play, much like in Annie Hall, the play in Annie Hall, the characters in the play are played by, they're not played by the real people in Caden's life. They're played by actors who are dressed up to look like Caden and the other people in his life, but they're not actually him. So as to say, or at least in my opinion, that the imagined or the projected versions of the people that we imagine, right, when we imagine things, when we remember things, when we think about things, they're not the actual people. Like the little people we have in our heads, they're not the actual people that we're trying to remember or think about. They're not saying the exact same things. They're not standing in the exact same way that people stood or said the things that they said when we first experienced those things that we're trying to recollect. And this is what I was trying to say before about how apt the metaphor of the play is. They are performances. They are portrayals of the events that transpired. And not only that, but the film makes an important point about how memory or introspection, that we aren't simply vomiting out our memories like onto a stage, right? We're not just the producers and the director. And this is where I hope that brief explanation I did before makes a little bit more sense. We're not just simply vomiting things out onto a stage, right? We're not just the director and the producer or even just the actor. But we're also reflecting on those things when we recollect them. We don't just recollect things for no reason. We're telling them these stories to an audience, and that audience is us. Right? When we have a memory, we're reflecting on something and then learning on it as we project it. There's an interplay there. So the implication of all that is that these figures, these figments of our imagination, even though they are meant to be portrayals of things that actually happened, we're not only just projecting them, but we're learning, we're taking directions from them as much as we are directing them, right? As much as we remember them, we also take directions back from them. And this is so perfectly depicted in the final sequence of this film, where Caden begins to start taking directions from the actor who is playing him in the play. I'm pretty sure it's the actor playing him in the play, but it's an actor from the play. But the point is that it's not him. It's this random, Kaufman's brilliant. Like, it's this random actor who's not really been, like, literally in the real world, actor who's not even really been in the film that much, becomes like the voice of God by the end of this random person. And that's kind of what happens in life. We have these memories of things that come up in our dreams. And speaking of dreams, it's a very nightmarish quality to this film. So it seems I have to make that point very briefly. But we start to take directions from these random portrayers, these random performers that are performing things that we live by, and we start to interpret those things back again. So what does that say about art and more importantly life? Well, kind of, you know, on a basic level, everything and everyone everywhere can be an interesting story. But not only that, when we reflect on these stories, which we have firstly interpreted from a unique standpoint to begin with, from a unique perspective to begin with, we then take directions from performers that are not actually portraying the truth in a pure and perfect way. So not only is life subjective in the sense that we view it from our own unique perspective, the specific place in time and space where we see everything, but then when we introspect, we're getting things back again. It's the subjectivity is squared. The subjectivity is compounded, which is to say, just on a basic level, things aren't just, the way we interpret the world isn't just subjective. It's very subjective. It's not just that you see things from your own unique perspective, but the things that you're recollecting and seeing are then through the lens of another projected perspective again. And it goes in and out and in and out. And so this leaves us with kind of like a very existential and anxiety-inducing question, which is that if there is more out there than we can ever know, like all of these stories that we can never really unpack all of them, and there is no one also that we can truly trust, including ourselves in recollecting all these things, and there's so much subjectivity about how we all observe the phenomena that exist in reality, what on earth are we to do? How can we believe in truth? How can we know what is up and what is black and what is white? How can we know anything in this world? And we're asking this question, we're very much bringing in the basic postmodern, some might say late stage capitalism, post truth questions that we've definitely been dealing with in the mainstream. Mainstream media, mainstream culture for the last, let's say, 7 or 8 years, right? Especially this sort of post-2016, nothing in the media can be trusted. This is something that's front and center now in the culture. And we've seen, and we certainly see this in the next film, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse from this year, which is the sequel to the first Spider-Man Enter the Spidey-Verse or something. And I got to say from the front, I don't know, I'm not a comic book guy. I loved the Tobey Maguire Spider-Mans when I was little, and I was not that excited to see this movie, but I was blown away by it. I think it's excellent. And I went in cynical, to be honest. And I much preferred the sequel to the first one. I watched the first one so I'd understand the second one. And I was like, the first one I kind of liked. The second one, really liked it. Thought it was very good. And I'll explain why. So we've now reached this point in culture where this idea of reality being truly infinite and we don't know where truth is, where it sits, as we mentioned earlier in today's show, is well and truly embraced in the culture. Like, we've got the Avengers with the multiverse and Doctor Strange and that stuff, but also the Oscar-winning film Everything Everywhere All at Once is very much about, and we certainly could have done that this week, except it's not set in New York. But why this one in particular? Well, this film specifically tackles, I think, this question of if everything, everywhere, and everyone is worth paying attention to, if there's that many infinite stories, right? If we should be trying to observe, if we should or could observe and learn something from every single thing that exists and every single person, right? The postmodern condition, everything is potentially a story, then kind of nothing is, right? How do we decide what stories to tell? And I think just on – we're going to break that down in a second, but before we do, just with respect to this film specifically, I guess talking about this film, why does the life or story of some kid living in Brooklyn have any significance as opposed to anyone else, right? And that's the thing he's undergoing as an individual. He looks out at this sprawling metropolis. He's like, why does my life matter? But then they really steel man this question in the sequel because it's – or I guess in the first one as well. But they the racist say, like, okay, well, you know, even if someone is Spider-Man, who is an interesting person, who does sort of sit above the rest, you know, in the context of a multiverse where there are infinite Spider-Mans – or Spider-Men, Spider-Women, why that Spider-Man? And that's very much carried in the dialogue too in this film where he goes to the parent-teacher interview and she lifts up the piece of paper, if you've seen it. She goes, every kid is their own universe, and she shows that blank page. So it's lifting up this idea of like if every person has this extensive and expansive backstory and lore, why should we pay attention? Even if you raise the stakes and talk about, you know, and think about heroes through history. Think about, I always think about someone like Douglas Fairbanks, who was the big deal, you know, 80, 90 years ago in cinema, but no one talks about them anymore. Like significance is relative, and the more you expand out to the different levels, the different dimensions, the different multiverses, etc., the less and less significance in a given context, unless someone has significance, you know, it's limited by context. So let's break this question down so we're not leaving this episode feeling depressed and nihilistic. Well, let's break down the first part of the question. We said, you know, if everything everywhere and everyone is worth paying attention to, how do we decide what stories to tell? The first part, everything everywhere and everyone is compelling. Well, this film definitely turns its mind to tackling this sense of overwhelmingness, right? Spider-Man, I think, is actually like the perfect character for a film about overwhelmingness and multiverses and things like that. Just on a basic level, the motif of webs, right? Webbing, network, like when you watch Everything Everywhere All at Once with the little webs and everything like that, and they use that same imagery in this film. I just think that works. It's very neat. I just really like how they did that. But the second part is Spider-Man. I remember reading this in one of those books in the library at school. But Spider-Man, what's innate to Spider-Man's life? He's not like Batman where he lives off in a cave on his own. He's also trying to study, and he's got a girlfriend. He's got Aunt May and all that. The juggling act that Spider-Man has to pull off is very innate to his character, and it's also very relevant to the 21st century, where we've got, I don't mean to keep banging on about everything everywhere all at once, but also this idea of hustle culture, having a side hustle, the workday never ends, maximizing productivity. You see guys on Instagram reels constantly talking about, you know, my day is 18 hours a day, I have a coffee here, I get up at 2:38, like that kind of 21st century maximizing labor utility. And there's actually a line in the film where MJ, I think, says, there is no playbook. All you can do is make the right adjustments at halftime. So as to say, no one knows the right thing to do any given minute. There's so many options to take all the time. We often feel overwhelmed that we have to do everything because we don't know which specific line to go down. I've got to do this work. I've got to get this girlfriend. I've got to marry this person. I've got to go play this sport. I've got to do everything. Because if I don't do exercise, and if I don't study, and if I don't work hard, something's falling, and it's like doing the spinning plates constantly. And the idea is that you constantly have to just have to make adjustments if things start to feel like they are more or less significant. There's no one way to live your life. So let's break down the second part. Like maybe we can solve this problem in the second part because things are very overwhelming. So how do we pick which stories to tell this or which stories to pursue? Who to listen to, right? Whose story we should listen to in this grand scheme of things? Well, while we are all very unique and all our experiences on some level are all of our experiences on some level are derived from a shared human condition. Right? You could call that human instincts. Jung called it the collective unconscious. But, you know, we're all reacting to the same surroundings. We're all on some level reacting to planet Earth, right? So there are mutual patterns in everyday life. And another way of saying that is there are archetypes. There are motifs that exist in every culture, every person, every individual. And despite that, the fact that this film embraces the idea of the multiverse, we see it very much deal with this idea of patterns and mutual patterns and archetypes and stuff in two main ways. One with respect to the characters and the second with respect to the narrative and narrative motifs. So with respect to the characters, I mean, we've got Spider-Man. Spider-Man himself is an archetype, right? And I love how the film does this thing where it goes into all the different universes, and the same core idea of Spider-Man with the blue and the red and the web slinging and the saving innocent people is there, but it shows up in all these iterations of the different cultures. So they go to like Mumbai, they go into the real world, they go into the future, they go to like a British 80s punk context. And while they all have slight different variations and they're all different iterations, they all have that the core archetypal quality of a superhero, of Spider-Man, right? But then also in terms of the key plot points as well, in terms of the narrative, so that sort of evokes the idea of archetypes, because that's what we see in stories and everything. You might go to a different country and they call the person a different thing, but, you know, they all have the core same, you know, the idea of the archetypal hero, the core idea is the same everywhere. But also in terms of the narrative, right? There's this really cool thing they do in this film where they talk about how all the different Spider-Men have these key plot points in all of their respective stories, and they name these key plot points canons. So, for example, the uncle figure being killed, or some important cop figure in everyone's life, or everyone, all these Spider-Men have their own upside-down kiss moment, you know, the classic sort of moments, the key plot points in all of these Spider-Man stories. And I think it's really clever they call them canons, because if you think about, like, the idea of, like, the Western canon or literary canons, we're talking about a collective of stories in which the most important lessons and morals of the human condition, of human life, are contained. Anything that doesn't fit in the canon doesn't go right to the heart of what it means to be human. So I really like that of them calling them canons. So to try and tie everything together there, I suppose that, and also I should say, I mean, I don't want to give away the end of the film, but the film, I think, very cleverly leaves this up in the air as to sort of to the extent to which these archetypal, these patterns should be held sacred, and to what extent they should be held sacred. But let's not go into that. I don't want to give up too much of the thing. Let's bring things to a close today, right? When we talked about Annie Hall, we talked about the idea that art is more than just a good time, right? It's actually the outpouring of a person's concerns with the world around them. And this is actually something we've talked about a lot, but we talked about when we did the idea on creation many a year ago now, we did that episode. But the idea of breaking the fourth wall really grabs the audience by the collar and says, no, this is not just a good time. This is an actual story that happened to me, a real person. And we see this also, of course, in all of Charlie Kaufman's work, not just in Synecdoche, New York. But there is an issue with that. In saying that every person has their own story to tell, there are so many people out there. And so there are so many stories to tell. And one can become quite overwhelmed with paying attention to every single person that's ever lived throughout history. And thus we see the reason why human culture oscillates between realism and the archetypal. Because when we embrace realism too much, we become so debilitated by seeing poetry and seeing narrative in everything. You know, if you think back to a movie like American Beauty, you know, you can see a story in a plastic bag, for goodness sakes. If you're seeing a story everywhere, it kind of makes it very difficult to know what to pay attention to. So in order to avoid that kind of state of nihilism where everything is worth paying attention to and therefore nothing is, we can still, we should seek out these patterns that exist in all the stories, kind of filter through all the stuff that's not important, which kind of points us toward the archetypal, you know, these core figures that exist again and again, these core ideals that exist and that are held up as noble in every single culture. So perhaps the next time you find yourself lost in this endless and seemingly nihilistic jungle that is the multiverse, try to look out for those towering archetypes that rise above the skyline. Well, that's all we've got time for this week on Sacred Cinema. I've been your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, here on 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. Please stay tuned for more quality radio programming here on 2XX. And consider jumping onto our website if you're not there already to consider subscribing to the station or sponsoring the show. We'd appreciate all of that. But also feel free to get in contact by emailing me at contact@jimmybernasconi.com. We'll see you again next week. Cheers.